You've seen this, right?
London stood on the brink of an abyss as the city drowned in its own sewage.
I don't want to show you this part in the beginning.
But one man believed he had the answer. An unknown engineer with a vision of a subterranean world. He would undertake the largest construction in England. It would become a lifetime struggle against a Victorian world blind to his vision for the first modern metropolis. The name of that unknown engineer, Joseph Bazalgette. Suspected that the smell of sewage alone could strike a man dead. They were convinced that the thick fog hanging over the city spread the disease. They called it the miasma. This was believed by Florence Nightingale and other leading health authorities, amongst them Edwin Chadwick and William Farr.
The miasma is all about us. Rises from the breath of 2 millions of people. From sewers and cesspools, graves and slaughterhouses. In one season, it carries cholera. In another, scarlatina, influenza, measles, smallpox. For centuries, it has hovered over London like an angel of death.
It is simple. All smell is disease.
Edwin Chadwick was so certain that the disease was caused by smell that he committed a terrible error.
We are going to make sure we remove the smell from London by flushing the sewers into the river. If we can control the smell, we will control the cholera.
So Chadwick flushed out the old sewers. Overnight, years of accumulated waste were washed and scoured straight into the Thames. But it didn't help. The death toll continued to rise. The disease struck its victims with devastating speed. The first symptom of cholera was acute diarrhea. Severe dehydration followed, causing the liver to weaken.
Does that make it airborne?
The skin turned a grayish blue color.
Airborne?
Death.
They said it was airborne.
The graveyard started to overflow. In the East End, there were riots because the poor could not even bury their dead. Corpses often had to be kept for weeks. Families ate and slept next to their dead. The body surrounded by onions to hide the smell.
We are living in an age where child mortality is commonplace. But why should it be so?
He's an engineer. He's not known at all in epidemiology. But he should be.
My mother lost 4 children, 2 of my sisters and 2 baby brothers. The grief at times is
so all. This is 1847, 48, 49.
Cholera is ruthless.
This is the second epidemic in England. The first one was 1832.
Cleansing London is the most pressing concern of the day, yet still, Parliament will grant us neither the money nor the power.
And people didn't know about bacteria yet. Or germs.
Before Before the epidemic ended in the winter of 1849, more than 14,000 Londoners had died.
50,000 in England.
And still, no one understood the disease. No one knew what caused it, or how to stop it spreading. Should not return.
What is cholera? Is it a fungus, an insect, a miasma, an electrical disturbance, a deficiency of ozone, a morbid off-scouring of the intestinal canal? We know nothing. We are at sea, in a whirlpool of conjecture.
Cholera had defeated the finest minds of Victorian medicine. But in Soho, one doctor was gathering evidence for a new theory on the cause of the disease. John Snow, pioneer in the fields of anaesthetics and epidemiology, a man ahead of his time.
The drunkard.
Snow was the first to doubt the miasma theory.
The proliferation of disease is generally ascribed to noxious exhalations. But how can that be when its distribution is so uneven? During the recent epidemic, the dwellings on this side of the street suffered fearful devastation, whereas in the dwellings on the other side there was but one fatal case. Yet their occupants breathed the same air. Surely, if cholera was caused by miasma, both sides would be equally affected. Is that not curious?
Working just one street apart,
this is the standard poster child for epidemiology now, but it's only a small piece of the story, actually.
Yet, ironically, they never met. Then, in 1853, the disease returned.
The mortality in this limited area probably equals any in the country. More people have died here in the past few weeks than during the plague.
600.
From the start of the new outbreak,
McGill campus.
Snow had been meticulously plotting the spread of the disease.
The distribution is remarkable. Houses marked in black have suffered cholera deaths. The outbreak is concentrated here in Broad Street, in the vicinity of a pump, which enjoys a high reputation for the taste and purity of its water. There are 11 other pumps in the district. It around wells there is virtually no cholera. An army officer from St. John's Wood died in Soho, drank water from the pump and was dead within hours. A coffee shop owner supplied her customers with the same water at dinner time. 9 died the next day. The percussion cap factory in Broad Street supplies its workers with the pump water. So far, 18 of them are dead. Yet, the brewery almost next door, where the workers drink only beer, has suffered no deaths at all. But most convincing of all is the case of a widow and her niece, who hailed from Hampstead, a high and healthy part of the city. When both ladies succumbed to cholera at the beginning of the outbreak, I was at a loss to explain why, until I interviewed the widow's son, who informed me that his mother once lived in Soho, where she developed such a taste for the Broad Street water that she had a bottle sent up every day by carrier's cart. Both ladies drank the bottle on Thursday and were dead by Saturday. Ergo, cholera cannot be caused by miasma, atmospheric humidity, or bad air. This proves without a doubt that it is spread in the water supply. Cholera is a water-borne disease.
Okay, Mark,
so cholera spread by drinking water.
Just from the historical perspective, you were talking about pandemics and the rest.
So when he presented health problems, they dismissed it out of hand.
I'm going to give you the link to this later on today, but we showed some of this when we did the last year, completely lost. Yeah, when we did the mini-med.
I may have shown you this already, but we did the lecture series for the public about 5 years ago for the history of the department. And so I showed some of the things, and I actually took some of the pictures from this book here, which is an amazing book called The Extraordinary Stories Behind History's Deadliest Killers. They took the 30 most deadly killers of all time. You can just pass it around. And we talked about three of them. But I put a lot of material on one page. So I've put it all on one page, all the stuff to do with my lecture. But in there, I covered a bit about epidemics. And this is the book. And there's some, the table of contents goes through, it actually goes through all of them. Yeah, so here are the several ones. I talked about cholera, I guess, the plague, and smallpox, which is the only one eliminated so far. But this series, the lecture series on epidemics, is fantastic. It's really, he's a guy in Yale. It's a course that he gave to undergraduates at Yale on the history of epidemics. So things that we're discussing right now about quarantine are a big piece of history in epidemiology. You know, do they work? Do they work? That sort of thing. Right? So that's why it's highly relevant, again, this sort of thing. Yeah, Hopkins has another one. The BBC has a very good one on modern medicine in general. This one is unusual. This is a very, very interesting movie, if you ever can see it, about what would happen if we had an outbreak of smallpox in Montreal again, or SARS, or Ebola, or whatever. Yeah. These are quite interesting maps. This is the book, the title of the cover, and this was actually inspired. This book, when you look at that picture, what does it make you think of?
Monster.
Monster, yeah. Anything else in it? Because this was in 1832, just as the cholera was about to invade England. It was in Russia and Northern Europe, and it was marching west, and they knew it was coming. And you saw that article from the Lancet that in 1932. That was the first time they were wondering, what are we going to do? It's going to reach London for sure, England, and it reached the north of England first, by ship, obviously, not by plane like today. Yeah. But this is their idea in 1832, no germs. So what are the main messages you're getting from this? Ghost, yeah, so hidden, you can't see it, yeah. Anything else?
It's huge.
It's huge, yeah, it's scary.
Unstoppable,
like, that's right, even the wars and the guns can't stop it. Yeah, so it's an amazing picture. Yeah, painted in 1832. Yeah, and I think also the idea of clouds, you see miasma and clouds, as though there's these clouds of airborne stuff. Everything was airborne in those days. Malaria was airborne, cholera was airborne, everything was airborne. And a lot of people didn't believe it. That's what Snow was saying. You know, that people knew better, they ran when things came along. And if it was airborne, it wouldn't help you to run, right? So that's why the woman from Hampstead, to me, is the most important story in the cholera story. Because she was 5 miles away, and he's basically saying, how did the cholera pick her out from the wind? You know, the wind decided to stop at her house. Well, yeah. So to me, of all the pieces, that, and I guess the idea that the brewery people didn't get cholera either because they weren't drinking the water from the pump. But in the presentation, if you want to go back through it, there's a much bigger piece to the story about Jon Snow that I think is more convincing. And that's the Soho was central London, and it was 600 deaths in 1 week in an area the size of McGill. But somebody made the very, and he plotted the map, and most of the cases were around one pump. And he said, it's got to be the pump. But he never proved it. He wrote the book, he got the data, he did everything, showed, and he drew maps showing that you couldn't, if this was the, you know, even, and I think some people were walking from other pumps, going by them, because they liked the sweet water of that pump. So he had actually drawn a map showing what are the, is it worked or tessellated or some kind of a map in epi, in math, about being closest distances to things. And he worked it all out. But he was, a lot of critics, obviously. What would be the biggest criticism of his proof that it was waterborne? So everyone thinks it's a great piece of epi. It's actually got lots of holes in it, and nobody believed him. And he died having convinced nobody, except maybe William Farr. For about 20 years later, he actually, or 15 years later, he actually intervened and finally got proof. But what, and you have to see the end of the movie. The proof is that the smoking gun, which you saw, is at the end of the movie, and it's pretty dramatic. And it's hard to explain it away. But what was I going to say? Yeah, so what would be the biggest objection if you see this map centered on a pump, and there were 13 other pumps around?
I guess, like, what makes that one pump infectious as opposed to...
Well, that's one thing. You've got to show me the infection in it. That's one. Show me what's special about this pump. Because what?
It drew water further down the river.
All pumps are connected.
No, they weren't. These pumps were actually local boreholes. They were not through the service. No, they were boreholes. Yeah, they were not for the common water at all. No. They were all local ones. Yeah, they were building a water. No, I don't think they had water systems. The water companies were selling water, yeah, through pipes. But the pumps were separate, as far as I know. But there's a major objection that people didn't... some people were really strong critics. Said this is fake. You know, this is not real. It doesn't convince me of anything. And that was very interesting. He said, "Look, if it was anthrax, if it was something in the wind, if it was an explosion, if it was a common source of, you know, something that dropped from the sky, London was so full of water pumps." That if it dropped from the sky, it was for sure going to hit one of the pumps. See what I mean? He's saying if it would have been near one of the pumps, whichever pump it was near, they'd blame that pump. So it's a very strong logical thing, you know, but we don't think of it at the time. So be careful when you're trying to make inferences, is what I'm saying. So I was never very convinced by it either, but, you know, just from what I saw. But Snow's first logic was actually physiological logic. He said, what are people getting sick from? They're getting sick from diarrhea. If that was over in where we're looking now, diarrhea would not suspect airborne. You would expect something ingested into the food tract. And so his main thing was there was fever, there were other things, and so on. Things that go with the lung. There are things that go with the lung, the ones we're seeing now, that are different than the ones that go with the gut. And so he figured out a lot of it with logic, and then three or four data stories, like the one with the apartments where there was a mess up with the pipes, and cholera people's excrement was going into the water and being recycled back into other people's water supply. That's where he spotted what was going on, with a few small examples. So in 1849, he didn't have much evidence, and he was waiting for the big epidemic, although the epidemic of 1849 was 50,000 people killed. It was the biggest one in England, and about 10,000 in London. But he waited to 1853-54 when the cholera came back again. And there was a very nice, some people call it natural experiment. Actually, I can show you, it's easier to show you that. Come on, wake up. Okay. It'll be easier just to show you here. Where's the slide? So that's Smallpox, by the way, was a big riot in Montreal. People didn't want vaccination against smallpox in Montreal. They didn't want quarantine in Montreal either. There was a huge issue about building hospitals here in 1885 for this issue. Riots in the street, and it became a Catholic, Protestant, French, English thing as well. So the church was against a lot of things. They were against quarantine and so on, and they thought, you know, the same old things. It's poison from the sky. It's the English killing us. It's this kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. And they had some reason for that, but yeah. So that's cholera. So now there is the epidemic of 1849, and that's 50,000. And what do you notice here? There's the January to December, right? There were the highest deaths in any one day was 1,050 across England. Yeah, and one day that's in whatever. Right? But this is spreading across the whole of England. Now, I have reconstructed with the students. They published the day-to-day counts of death by region, so you can map it today. And somebody with GIS and other visual skills needs to map this thing, because we have it, the spread of it by county. We have the data at the county level for every day of the deaths, not of all the cases, but of the deaths. And by the way, why do you think the case fatality rate is for cholera? Case fatality rate, that's a new word for you, right? Yeah. Case fatality rate.
Is it like the fatality rate for each case, for each special one, given all the kind of medical condition?
It's very general. It's not conditional on anything. The one thing it's conditional on is, like, what's the case fatality rate for the moment for a coronavirus?
Is it low? Well, like, as in...
We don't know yet, the whole one, yeah, but so far... Huh? 1%? 1%, 2%, yeah, yeah. Case fatality rate is the death rate among those infected. It's how many of the sick die. That's the case fatality. It doesn't have a time scale on it, because normally people, you're either going to recover quickly or you're going to die. So we know in a week or 2 weeks what's going to happen. So that's what case fatality is. The case fatality rate, though, gets mixed up with other things because of the scariness with which it spreads. So the case fatality rate in cholera was actually quite low. Again, 2-3%. But it was the scariness and the quickness with which it killed people, the ones it did kill, who didn't get rehydrated and so on like that, whatever, that was scary. And so William Farr had a very interesting story. He said, look, if you were in London in 1850 and you had to get one of two diseases, which one would you prefer to have? I will give you two choices, cholera or TB. Tuberculosis. Cholera or tuberculosis? And most people are so scared of the cholera, because it's just like the Ebola, but Ebola has a very high case fatality rate, practically 100%, right? If you're not careful. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But so which would you take? As a betting man. Cholera or TB?
Cholera.
You'd take the cholera. Why?
There's higher chance of survive from the disease.
Yeah, there's about a 98% chance you'll be okay. But in TB in 1850, it was a death sentence. It was only a matter of how long, probably 2-3 years. Right? 2-3 years, and it was 100% fatality practically from case fatality rate from TB. But it took a lot longer. So the whole issue of fear and, you know, strange things come into this even then. Come on, wake up, this thing wants to, yeah. So anyhow, so this, you see here the theories about the spread, miasma, contagion, vapors. We're talking about cholera, just so you know, infectious disease we're talking about. But at the time, they said it was all airborne, right? Pollution, basically, bad smell, you saw? Chadwick, public health guy, very good guy, well, heart in the right place, but wrong theory, all smell is disease. And he was one of the reasons that when Snow died, who did a big contribution, and he did contribution to anesthesia as well, Snow's obituary in the Lancet didn't even mention the epidemiology, just that he was a noted anesthesiologist. And he had a fight with the Lancet and the British medical establishment because he testified on behalf of people who were in smelly industries, especially things like tanneries. You know, they were using skins of animals and curing them, making fat, making candle wax, making, you know, rendering out very smelly diseases. So nobody wanted these factories and these processing places near them. So he helped the union of these kinds of workers to say that there was nothing wrong with smell. Living next to a tannery or a smelly place, just because they were boiling fat and doing stuff, smelly stuff, wasn't going to hurt you. But the medical establishment got furious at him for that. So that's why he got blacklisted. Yeah. So anyhow, you see, here he is, yeah. So now, there's the death. So here's his pamphlet. And in the pamphlet, and somebody in public health should really take this and do it, he had several theories and logic as to why this was that. He didn't say it couldn't be spread person to person. It would be. But it was this fast way, the fast route was by water. The mass distribution from one chunk to another was by water. Right? And then once you got sick, and I was looking after you, and washing your clothes when you got sick, and feeding you and so on, you gave it to me, and you could pass it on food and other things, right? But the fast way was water, to hurry it on. So that's him, and this is a very good story, yeah. But you see, I dropped the pump, well, I put it later, the one about the pump, which is what everybody in Italy gets. But do you know about this one?
The Johnstone pump?
No, yeah, everyone knows the Johnstone pump. You know, if you want to test, a quick test of whether somebody is an epidemiologist, or a fake epidemiologist. Like, we had a guy here one time come into one of our parties. We had a reception downstairs or something. And this guy walked in, and none of us knew him. And then we found out later he just came for the food. And so we were trying to figure out what questions would you ask somebody to unveil them. And so that was what I always said. If you asked, you know, any epidemiologist to their dying day would remember John Snow. And the other one we used to have is, what's the color of a certain textbook? The time when you actually bought books, if he didn't know, or fill in the blanks, Mantell and Henson, right? If you didn't know that, you weren't an epidemiologist. Or Kaplan and
Meyer,
right? Okay, there you're biostat. That's the code word for a biostat. Yeah, so anyhow, yeah, but not many know this part of the story. It's in Rothman's early books, and it's a very good story. So in London, the pipes, the companies that were selling water, just like Videotron are selling the providers today, they didn't go in competition with each other. So one company would take one area, another would go another. They didn't want to be in competition, just like the Videotrons today. But there was this one area where there were two companies fighting for customers. And when they were putting down the pipes on the road, they would go and knock on doors and ask, do you want to sign up with us? We'll give you a deal, seventh, you know, drink free or whatever it is. And the other guys, same thing. So there was strict competition. And John Snow knew that, and he took advantage of this, that there was a natural experiment where people were practically divided at random, he says in his thing. And they were really, it was a very clever thing. So he was just waiting for the next epidemic to come. He had seen this already, and he had kind of seen the data. But one, so there's a green area and a red area, and then this is the overlap area. And these are two companies. Both of them were taking their water from here. This is Westminster here, the Big Ben. It's right down there. One of them's taking their water from there, and the other was taking it from here, just before the turn in the river. And these are the, yeah, so these are the deaths in 1849, in the big epidemic. Right? So what do you see? This was slightly above water. They had a 75 per 100,000 or whatever this is, deaths per 100,000.
right? This is a bad area, and this is a bad area as well, right? This is below Parliament, that's, right around there. So they were both bad, but something else very natural happened. And that was the government was sort of knew about the bad water and so on. I don't know for what reason, whether cholera or just bad water, dirty water, because you take it from the centre of London. And the thing with London is a tidal city. You know, Montreal doesn't have the tide come in here. So we're fresh water and the water is only flowing downstream. If you're down river, Quebec City, further down, there's tides. So that the water comes back and forth. So I always say, in London, if you threw a dead horse in the river in London, it would take 3 days to go down, because it would go down part way, the tide would come in, and it would be like this, and it would take a long time to go out. So, you know, had all this extra smell and stuff and disease in the river for all that time. So that actually is a critical point later on. So, so he's waiting now, but the government is on to these water companies to move their intake of the water up river. Take your water in from the river way up where it's clean. And by 1854, this company, I think it is, had already moved its intake. And now it was taking the water from a place around Heathrow Airport, which is 20 miles west of London, so much cleaner water. So if, and it's not the dirty water that's going to give you the cholera, it's dirty water with, it's water that cholera has gotten into. That's key. It's not just dirty water. There has to be cholera, fresh cholera going into the water to poison you. So now look at 1854. See? And now look what's happened. So this is one of the really nice experiments you dream of, natural experiments you dream about having in epidemiology. Right? Because it's all there, I think, now. Right? The company that completely changed, you know, went from the almost the worst to the best, right, by far. No change here. In fact, the epidemic was worse in this part of London, down here, and then here mixed. There was only a partial effect. Right? Yeah. And so this.
Did they get to choose which company? Is that like a thing? Hmm? Did they get to choose which company were they getting water from?
I'll come to that in a minute. He says it was pretty well at random. That there were two companies walking down. In many streets, there were two pipes. One from this company and one from the other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not completely clear. And it's a little murky, I'll tell you, for reasons you'll explain in a minute. Yeah, but it was pretty close to blind. And his statement of how close they were, it's like the table one, is really quite something. You've got to read it. I don't want to mess him up. And he was a very, very good writer. Almost poetic about it. Yeah, so exactly, because that's the first thing is, you know, isn't the richer getting one? No, he said there were many streets that had the two. So you see what I mean? This is much more interesting than the pump. Yeah. And the reason he's known for, I think it's called in the pump thing, he went around and interviewed people. It's shoe leather epidemiology. Have you heard that expression? Shoe leather epidemiology. What does shoe leather epidemiology mean? Well, you've heard of sneaker mail. You've heard of email, you've heard of sneaker mail. What's sneaker mail in a company?
Like you're walking in.
You walk over to the other guy's office in your sneakers and you go and bring the message or the information by sneakers, by your foot, right? Well, shoe leather epidemiology is the same thing. You actually go to somewhere and collect the data. You don't scrape it off the web. You go with your shoe leather. You wear your shoes out going around. Actually, John Snow didn't wear his shoes out. He went by carriage because he was a rich guy. He was a practitioner, and he used his money from anesthesia to fund his private research. And a lot of it was on cab fares. So he knew this epidemic was coming. The thing that bugged him, and it really bugged him. The government knew exactly how many customers there were of each type. there was so many here and so many here. And each, you know, they knew the distribution. Like this company had 40,000 customers and the other company had 26,000 customers. So they knew that. Because the company was obliged to report to the water companies. But they didn't know the individual ones. And they wouldn't give the list. They had it, but they wouldn't give the list to the government. So that's becomes a key point. So when John, when he now finds the deaths here in 1854, how is he going to do the analysis? He wasn't happy with just this, because this is very aggregate data, right? And having aggregate data, right, isn't very good, right? Because you can have ecologic problems, you can be really comparing one group of people with another group of people, and the people you think are getting the water are not. The deaths could be the people who are not getting the water, for all you know, because you haven't got a numerator, you know, you can't line them up and link them, right? So what he did is, I don't think it's in the movie, he got, for the first 4 weeks, the one thing that was good then, it's now kind of good for this one, because we're having almost daily counts around the world and deaths and cases and so on. In those days, the British government, the Registrar General's office, was on top of deaths very, very quickly. If I asked you, how many deaths were there in Montreal last week, or in Toronto last week, forget totals, just total deaths, not even by cause. It was going to take 12 months before you find that out. So there's no way you'll find an epidemic of anything quickly here. Right? How did they find the epidemic from the heat in Paris in 2003 or whatever it was? It was the heat, there was a big heat wave in Paris. How did they notice that there was a huge excess? And there was all the government knew. The government was away on vacation. It was August. The government wouldn't have those data for another year. How do you think they found out? How do you public health people? You've got to know your sources. What do you think? So there's a big excess. We don't know individual cases. We're not talking about attribution at the individual level because there's somebody died of heat. We don't know. All we know is there's an awful lot of extra deaths these days compared to what it was a year ago. How would you notice that? Think about it. Who in the city would be the first on top of knowing that there's a huge excess of deaths the last couple of weeks in Paris? The coffin makers. The coffin suppliers. Yeah, and there was another agency in France called the Pompier, what the heck is it? The guys who come around, they're like for 9/11 kind of people, you know, rescue, forget the name for them now. Huh? Yeah, but anyway, the coffin makers ran out of coffins, exactly. You ran out of those. It's like running out of masks today, you know, the same thing, yeah. So anyhow, but London and Britain had a very good vital statistics system and they had a reason for it. That system had been around unofficially from about 1500 or 1600 onwards. There was an unofficial death system of recording deaths in England and it was called the Bills of Mortality. Anybody heard of it? The Bills of Mortality. The bills, a bill is just something you put up on a poster. Right? There was a company, always companies that trade on information, and these companies decided there was enough rich people in England who would like to know the number of deaths in London last week. So every week, on a Saturday, they added up and they had a tracking of all the deaths, fast reporting, and then they published, but they didn't give it to you for free, they sold these little pamphlets to the rich people who could decide whether to get out of London or not because there was an epidemic coming. So they were called bills of mortality. I think sometimes they were posted up there. They were kind of weird and the cause of death were strange and there were a lot of things not very good in them. There were no denominators, but it gave you a sense of what's going on. Right? So the bills of mortality were, and they started when the plague came to London. There was one in 1866 or 1865, the one before the big fire of London and so on. It was around the time Isaac Newton was a student in Cambridge, because he had a home for about 6 months off of Cambridge because of it. There was another one earlier. So those ones were the big ones that started this. And then whenever an epidemic was coming close, the bills of mortality became very, very important for rich people. So then, after that, the vital statistics people got into it properly and decided we're going to have proper, and they eventually had a cause of death classification and all that came about 30 years later. But they had reporters who sent in the death certificate, not the death certificate, the death notices from each little region of the thing, and they were all compiled centrally. And then every week, the Registrar General published the report of last week's death. The CDC does it today in Atlanta for communicable diseases. There's a weekly MMMR. It used to be a paper thing. It's probably web now. MMMR. Weekly mortality and something morbidity report. So these are very key things for catching things quickly. I mean, Google now and others are trying to find ways by Google searching whether things are spiking quickly. Yeah. So anyway, he went Snow went to the Registrar General where he got a list of the deaths in these two areas. And so he had 334 deaths listed by address. By address. So now what does he have to do? Oh, only in these areas. So he gets a list of 34. He probably gets them week by week, and he's doing it week by week. So he's going over there every week. So now the shoe leather epidemiology starts. So what does he have to do?
Find out the companies for each death?
Yeah, that's right. He finds out, because he has a total overall. Yeah, he needs the company for each death. Because he said one of the problems could be that, let's say you're living in this area, and it looks like it gets this kind of water, or that kind of water, or more of this than that, but you could be getting your water from the ditch, from outside. It may not even be from the company at all, right? You could be getting it at work, or you could be, yeah, exactly. So he had to go to 338 houses himself, and then he got an assistant after that to help him with the others. So he visited that many houses by himself in the south part, south of the river. And these are his comments. So now, and there's a whole story to how he asked that. But these are the numbers. There were 34 that were not getting their water from either company. 34 were getting water from miscellaneous places. And then 14 were getting it from, you see, they got it from somewhere else, the drain, the river, whatever. 14 got it from this company. And he knew the denominator altogether of this company. But now he can put the numerator. He's basically putting the numerators in the two places now. So he has 300 numerators, right? And he can put them, 14 of them only here, and 286 here. And he has one of the first rate ratios of all time, as far as I'm concerned, a 13-to-1 rate ratio there between the two, because he knew the denominator here. 40,000 roughly houses supplied by the one. That number came from the government, but it's the splitting of it that was he had to do. Because the company wouldn't give it to him. I don't know if the company knew it at that detail level or not. So now the mystery of how did he figure out it. So yeah. So he goes to the house, he says, sorry to bother you. I know somebody died here last week. I'm sorry. And whatever, can I ask you a couple of questions? So how is he going to work out which of the two you're in? And by the way, he found out that when he went to these addresses, about a quarter of them were the wrong address. So if you actually went trying to do it by computer, you would be very wrong. Right? He actually found out. I said, no, it's not, you're in the wrong house. No, it's the one across the street with the blue door. Right? It's the one, yeah. So he found out there was major misclassification. And in a later report, he has one of the nicest pieces I've ever seen explained in Epi of what misclassification does. And it's not as easy as you think. Misclassifying people the wrong way is very innocent looking, but he showed exactly how the ridge ratios you got from the misclassified data were diluted. You know, it makes sense. They're diluted. Okay, so how did he work it out? Let's finish the story. Give John Snow the credit now. So, all right, we go to your house. All right, so is this the right house? Yes, somebody died here last week. So then, all right, so what water was your dad drinking when he died? Or where was he getting his water from? All right, so how are you going to tell me? So, first of all, you could say it's one of these 34. We don't get from either company.
Well, I'm pretty sure they'd say I'm just drinking from the tap, right? They wouldn't say the company.
Huh?
I wouldn't think their first guess would be the company, but you have to ask which company you're with.
That's right. You have to ask which company are you with, yeah. And he couldn't get an answer. So, come on. How would you get an answer?
Bill.
At the bill. Yeah, so that's right. You think of a bill today. Show me your bill. I don't have a bill. Why don't I have a bill? Why don't you have a bill? This is something we forget when you think about data. How come they didn't have a bill? First of all, they didn't know which. Nobody used company, the number on the door. In those days, it didn't matter if you had the wrong address written down. People would find you. We're looking for you. Oh, yeah, him, he's over that. No, forget the number. He's over there. So they didn't use house numbers. The only one who used a house number was a postman. And you didn't get letters in those days, or bills, or anything else. So how the hell did they work it out? No bill, I'm sorry, I don't have the bill. What do you mean you don't have the bill? So who knows?
The companies?
The company, yeah, I hope they know. Yeah, oh yeah. Huh?
Is there a collector for, like you're paying the fee, so there's somebody that's going to these houses?
Yeah.
So yeah. They just follow?
You've got to go and get but he said, no, nobody comes from the company. Nobody comes from the company to collect.
So it's free.
It's not free.
Then how do they pay?
Keep thinking. Yeah.
What would they pay?
What about the landlord?
The landlord collects the rent, and in the rent is the charge for the water. Yeah. So, okay, where's the landlord? Let's go find the landlord. Well, he only comes around on Saturdays to collect the rent. So we never see him the rest of the year. In fact, he doesn't come, somebody comes. Yeah. So we're not going to get it from the landlord because, shoot, you know, I've been a week. I can't wait a week until each landlord that shows up. There was one other thing they actually found out. There was one clever trick they found out that two companies did things different. They didn't have the water on all the time. They would stop it for a while and do things and then fill it up at night and do things. And people knew by the times roughly which company did what thing and when they turn it on and off. So that was kind of a help. But Jon Snow realized that if he had this kind of sloppy data, he was already in trouble. Nobody would believe him. Nobody would believe him. That, yeah, I got the data from him. They told me this company starts the water at 6 in the morning. So come on, you know, we have enough criticism. So he wanted to nail it down.
Is it possible that it, like, tastes different?
No,
he did.
He said, you can't tell. One of the problems. He said, one of the big problems is you can't tell.
Okay.
Yeah, it can be clean looking, and there can be color in it. You won't tell the difference. So
I don't mean, like, the color.
No, but...
Just in general, like, if...
Yeah, he did say when you took a glass of water from each one, you put them side by side, one was murkier than the other. One was a bit... Yeah, but he said, again...
That's
what, my critics are not going to take that. Now, you work with the chemistry people. Jon Snow is an anesthesiologist, so he has had courses in chemistry, quite a serious chemist. One other thing that I mentioned to you that he knew about, of course, about the water at London, the water, the tides. You see where we're going?
At certain times of day, it would be saltier if it's further downstream.
It would be salty all the time. Yeah. There was a lot more salt in the water if you took it from downtown London than if you took it from Heathrow Airport. So he took the water home. It's in his book. Nobody reads the original book. Rothman almost missed the best stories in the Jon Snow thing. The best high-tech story of that. There's a low-tech shoe leather, but there's a high-tech story. he did a sort of a discriminant analysis, or a cut point. He had a cut point where he had independently worked out where he knew the truth. He could work out that the salt would be this much here and this much here, and he put a line in the middle. And he said anything above that is downtown, and anything below that is whatever. And it was a pretty clear demarcation. So he had a very high-tech way of getting his data without ever asking anybody any. He said in a few cases, obviously, or if they had the bill, he believed the bill. But he said, if I didn't, I took a sample of water, took it home, and at night, you have to do, you probably know how to get, figure out the water, the salt, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Something with silver something?
Nitrous silver.
That's right. That's in the book. John Snow was on top of that in 1854. So it's an amazing story. So, you know, we could tell that. It's a whole story by itself for 2 hours if you wanted to go through the whole thing. But his book is damn good. The other book that's excellent is The Ghost Man, which, you've read it?
I've seen it.
Huh? Yeah. It's The Ghost Man. Anyway, that's the story. And now this is pretty damning, right? I mean, this is really damning now. How else are you going to explain? There was a big debate about whether socioeconomically this area is worse than this area. And he didn't have the data at a breakdown level, but later on he collected data in like neighborhood by neighborhood and showed that they're very close. And he even did something where he could match them up and do like a Mantel Hensel, but he never did the Mantel Hensel. He just showed that in every area they were about the same. So we're still trying to write up that piece. Yeah. So this is the pump, which is only 500 deaths. The other one was what? 300 deaths in 1 month. He continued that on until December. So he had 4,000 or 5,000 deaths by December. And so this began. But what happened is the 13-to-1 went down to about 7-to-1. And why would that happen? So early on, there was a very, very strong signal of 13-to-1. Why does it go down the more data you get?
Stabilize?
But why? Stabilize in a funny kind of a way. The signal is being washed out. I believe this signal, because it's kind of pure. But what's washing it out as you go further on?
Enough people to die.
Huh?
Not enough people to die.
Oh, plenty of people to die. You're only losing 1 or 2%. So it's not like all the susceptibles are gone. No, that's not the case here.
Like, as time goes by, like, people are getting, like, stronger ability to immune the virus?
Maybe. You're right, that's what you're kind of saying as well, that it takes the weakest first. Yeah, so maybe, you're right, that could be another one. Yeah. The other one, I think, is that there's other, once these people, it's like now, once these people get sick and die, they can go to work. Not the people, other people can go to work, or go over to the neighbors, and cross-contaminate, so they can go to people in the other water company. See what I mean? If you have a neighbor who's on the other one, you could catch it over there, in the neighbor's house. So the longer this goes on, and also there's transmission by food, by surface transmission, not just water, so there's a lot of things coming in. But this was early on when it came first. You have the cleanest kind of way of looking at it. That's my interpretation anyway. He talked a little about that. Yeah, but yeah. And oh, there's one other important one. John Snow did this work himself. John Snow was the most careful guy. Other people got a bit sloppy, and then, in fact, yeah, one of the other things they did then, John Snow convinced the Registrar General to ask the question on the death certificate. When there was a report of the death, he asked that the person who filled out the death certificate determine the water. And that was probably sloppy. Right? John Snow has the sharpest data. The other guys were doing it looser. It was, you know, so there wasn't the same commitment. So quality goes down, so there's more merging and errors and so on. So it all kind of makes sense. Yeah. So he's well aware of these things. And he, what is amazing to me is, you know, a lot of people, even today, Mietnin says this, he says, a lot of people think the more data I have, the bigger the sample, the better. And Mietnin and Snow are kind of saying, no, sometimes the sharper, the better. Even if it's smaller and sharper, it's better than bigger and looser. You know what I mean? And there's a point to that. We're all for big numbers. Oh, I have N of this, I have N of that, that's good. Sometimes by breaking it down, you can see where it's sharper. And then if you have explanations why, I think it's more convincing. So let's to just go back then to the places I would go. The book is very good. I've put a few of the chapters on there. The courses on epidemics are fantastic. What's the thing? Where are the books? Yeah. This one is really good. You have to keep looking on YouTube to find it. It moves around. It gets, BBC takes it off, they get after YouTube, then it comes on another day again. So you have to look at it. This is a great story. Jon Snow's own book is good. Where did I say? Yeah, this is a fantastic story. It's mostly about the pump and how they finished the story to get the full data. So one of the key things that was missing, we said, is how do we know it's even contaminated? Jon Snow never established that. He wrote the book, ran to publish quickly. He didn't finish the story because I think he knew that the London, South London story was strong enough by itself. He never considered that the pump to be the smoking gun. He considered South London to be the smoking gun. But the ghost map guy explains how they went all the way back and finished the story and found case number one. And found why the cholera got into the pump. There was a defect that was missed twice by the city when they checked the pump and the bricks and all the mortar and all that. And after the third go-around, that a curer, a local guy, actually went and persisted and got it right. And he was skeptical at the beginning, and he, to me, he's the hero in this. The other hero in it is Jon Snow himself after he's dead, because William Farr then goes to East London, where there was another epidemic in 1866, and that's where the ugly thing in the movie is, remember? Yeah, you still remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, these are fantastic books as well on other things to do with how AIDS was, not AIDS, what am I talking about? This one, how cholera was introduced to Haiti for the first time. Complete a place that it never was before. And this is like a modern Jon Snow, because the United Nations denied it, and finally got caught in their lies, because a French epidemiologist, who was the hero of this book, came and figured it out. But it took an awful lot of work to have the UN even half admit that they were the cause of importing. And the importation came from how? How do you think importation came here?
Was it soldiers from Nepal or something like that?
Soldiers from Nepal, yeah. And in Nepal, you still have, here are the maps. So, this is the first pandemic. So where, see, we have the same kind of maps today. Where is the center? Over your part of the world, right? Yeah, the Bay of Bengal, right? Is that the Bay of Bengal? Mm. Huh? Yeah. It seems to be there's something about the water in the Bay of Bengal that the cholera, Vibrio, whatever, likes. So it hides out there, and every couple of decades it decides to go crazy and spread again and mutate or whatever. So it's something. It's endemic there, and then becomes out from there. But if you see, that's the first one. It's always there. Start with 1817. It took 20. You know, because of speed of transport at that time was pretty slow. Then the next one, the one where the one that occasioned this painting, right? It got as far as England, and then it got from England over to here very, very quickly.
Isn't like cholera like part of the natural seawater flora or something?
I think so. I think it's something to
and
do
it's
with that.
With tides, it gets into the wells when the tide comes up.
Something like that. And there's something about that and something about why it likes that area. Something about the water over there. Yeah. So this one is interesting because this is, it got to 1832. This is when you see that I have all the, I went through the 1832 literature about that, the books and the journals at the time, and the Lancet was trying to explain to people what to do. There was a big debate about whether we should quarantine the ports or not. Should we stop trade of boats coming from Europe? And I think they decided not to, that it wasn't going to work, that people would cheat. They would be, it would be impossible to actually have a quarantine in British ports to keep out the cholera. They were probably right. So they didn't do it. It came anyway. And then, And then it got from 1832, it arrived in Montreal that same summer. It's using a boat that came with mainly Irish people, I think. Yeah. And the reason we have the quarantine system, sorry, the first quarantine system in Canada was down the river from Quebec City. Anybody in public health at all? Yeah. Who's in public health?
I'm in public health.
Yeah. has anybody been down the river? I haven't even been to the island. There's an island called Gros Isle. G-R-O-S-I-S-L-E. And it was the first quarantine station, and it was set up, I guess, but the British were in charge of Canada at that time, I think. I don't think Canada was completely. So they set up this quarantine station below Quebec City. And when the boats came, they took off the sick, right? And so some of them were dead already, some were very sick, so they took them off, and then they left the boat, continued up to Montreal. And so cholera was in Montreal about 4 days later, 3 days later, right? And then it killed 4,000, 5,000 people very, very quickly through soldiers and all that. So, yeah, because they didn't, there was incubation going on. So they only took off the really obviously sick. They didn't screen the others. They had no way to do it. So there was people who were incubating and then had brought it up. And so and then, whatever. So it turns out, so Montreal is the first North American port of entry, or Quebec City, and Montreal are the first port of entry of cholera to North America. They're also the last city to have a big outbreak of smallpox, because they refused vaccination and refused quarantine and so on. So there, Montreal is known for the first and the last of the two diseases. But then we found out that New York City now says they're the first to have cholera. But at the time, they denied it. Why was that? Why do you think they denied it? And they denied, again, there was a big debate in 1880 when there were smallpox epidemics. People, cities didn't want anybody to know that there was cholera or smallpox in their city. Tourism, business, nobody wanted the trains to stop, nobody wanted the other thing. You know, it's repeating, history is repeating itself, right? Nothing is new. Yeah. So that's this one, and now it got as far as here. The third one, is the third one? Oh yeah, so there's the one. Yeah, so there's the number of deaths. Look at this. No, so where's your case fatality rate there? You don't know. Do you know the case fatality rate from that? But it's 2,000 out of however many got it. Mm-hmm. It's a lot though. The next one now, look how fast it's going. And of course, transport is getting faster. Things are getting farther down to the east coast of South America and so on, not around the west coast. Yeah, and then, what's that? This is the one in South London, in East London, the last time they had cholera outbreaks and serious epidemics in East London. And that's in the movie where they noticed what to do and they fixed it. And one of the big things also in the, you saw Snow's original message. His original message was, be careful, wash your hands. And what was the other thing he said, did you notice? In that 1849 pamphlet, which is only about 9 pages, he talked about boiling the water. And I had been trying to find anybody before that who was counseling boiling water, advising to boil the water for that purpose. They would boil water to get the smell out of it and kill things that they didn't know, but they didn't know there was germs. But Snow looks to me to be the first one who said boil water.
So Snow didn't... He hypothesized that there was germs and you boiled to kill it, or he just wasn't sure?
Yeah. He hypothesized there were germs, okay, and that boiling would kill the germs. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. No, he was very... I mean, he was... If you look at the logic, it's impeccable today. Yeah. But he didn't convince anybody. Yeah. So this is a very serious one here in Hamburg. If you think the Jon Snow map is impressive for being near all the cases near one pump, there's a much more impressive data set that nobody seems to know about from Hamburg in 1892. And now at this point, they already know it's bacterial. Because in 1870 or 1880, Robert Koch, the German microbiologist, had figured out a whole load of things on the microbe. Anthrax, cholera, TB, there's three of his at least that he had done. Cholera was one of them. He was the first to identify the cholera seriously in about 1870 something. So by 1890, Hamburg knows now that it's bacterial and whatever, but there were other funny theories going on and so on. So there was a fight in Hamburg, and Hamburg was not filtering their water. And the town next to Hamburg, called Altona, was filtering their water. And Hamburg wasn't, and the cholera got in because of the tide again. They were taking their intake above the city, before the sewers went in, above the city, but there was one storm that pushed the cholera up and back into the thing. So there's a map of Altona versus whatever with dots on it. I'm going to send it to you, the link. It's a big one. It's done in color, beautifully done by the German epidemiologist, and it's a fantastic story. And what Koch said, basically, cholera drew the border line between Hamburg and Altona. You can see black dots all over on the one side, and you can see practically no dots except spread by workers and transport and so on, on the Altona side. It's a remarkable, it's hundreds of, way bigger than any of his series. And it's a beautiful mapping thing that I think you would enjoy today, even with the color and everything. And there's a few little pockets in Altona that did get the cholera. And there are pockets in Altona because they actually were getting their city water from the other city. So again, it was another smoking gun. It had to be that. So now, you see, now it's coming down less, they're able to control it. Right? And, but now we're still getting cases today. And this is the sad story of Haiti one. This came in because the soldiers were there with the United Nations after the earthquake. So that's there's a lot of good. Anyway, I'll try and pick and choose for you what here, but there's a lot of good stuff here. And I think my main point of this is it's a point that a colleague of mine now retired, Jean-Francois Boivin, always said he was studying epidemiology at Harvard in the late 70s. And he said, Jim, you know that Harvard was actually thinking in the late 1970s of closing down the infectious disease department. There wasn't any need for it anymore. We've licked all those, we've cured all those infectious diseases. We should worry about cancer and heart disease and all that. 1977, 79. I kind of remember 1882 or 81 or 83 or whatever, the first reports of AIDS at the time, SARS, Ebola, and so on. So I think these viruses are going to be ahead of us all the time. One last thing, since we're going to go on to data now, amen? Just curious, what do you think of these? And then we have another mystery data set that we're going to do by logistic regression in a minute, but this one, as an example of logistic regression, but this one I want you to figure out what happened here. What are these events? Can I get a bit bigger? Sorry, shoot. There's it. And maybe I just leave it like this, but you'll have to go over here. See? This is at 24 o'clock, right? These are the number of events in 1 year in the United States. So this is the year, what did I hear, did I say? 2014. But it's practically the same pattern every year. Right? So this is the number of events. And these are aggregated over, there's how many, 52 Sundays in a year, roughly. So this is a sum over 52 Sundays, right? But the scale, keep an eye on the scale here. This is about, the resolution of this graph is of the order of, it's 1 minute. So I have counts per minute, okay? So like I have a count for today, for this minute, next minute, next minute, but I'll add that over all Fridays to get the total count for this minute for the year on Fridays, that's down here, right? And then we have the count for every other day as well. So it's a 24x7 map, right? At a resolution of 1 minute, right? But aggregating, it's not all continuous. They're aggregated, you know, you have to jump from, 7 days later. So, okay? Now, if you know this right away, don't say it. They leave a bit of fun for the others. Right. So, what's your impression? Can I narrow this a bit? I can't. I'm trying to zoom out. I can't do it very well. Yeah. A bit better. Yeah. Maybe zoom out again. Yeah. We're there. Okay. So what events are these? There's about 4 million, 5 million of them in the US every year. There's a few missing data, there's a little bit of records missing. It's about 4 million a year in the US. So what do you think it is? So, so Sunday is flat,
yeah,
and Saturday is flat. And then there's a different pattern for the 5 working days.
There are peaks in the morning.
Peak in the morning at around
8.
People commuting to work and then taking a lunch
break. Well, there seems like there's a lunch break here as well. Yeah. So you could say, is this the orders for Tim Hortons or the orders for Burger King or the orders for McDonald's coffee? Right?
Yeah.
It could, but it should be more than 4 million.
That's bad.
Right? It would be more than 4 million. But yeah, it could be.
I can guess.
Huh?
What about water intake? No.
These are events. It's not like gallons of water. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it could be gallons of water. No, it's events. There's a clicker. I'm clicking. Oh. Yeah. You know? You'd heard this before? No?
Car crashes.
Oh, okay, I see where you're going, right? Why? Because this is the rush hour? Okay. If it was car crashes, by the way, that number is absolutely flat. That's 250 at midnight. 250 on a Sunday morning. Would that be car crashes? No, the car crashes would be after the pubs close. Right? But then it probably at 5 in the morning would be when the fewest car crashes, right? When there's the fewest people on the road. So it doesn't quite fit. It would fit if it went down in the evenings and in the mornings, in the early morning. So it's not car crashes.
So it's flat.
Heart attacks?
It's flat. Yeah, it's flat. It's completely flat, but non-zero. It's 250 per minute. That's about 5 per minute per day. Because there's 252. Right?
Okay, so maybe not heart attacks then.
Same thing. Well, heart attacks can occur all the time, but
I don't know, mostly, like Monday morning, like everyone's
Yeah, that's what people think too. give you a bit of history. This is New York in 1932. This is other cities and places. I don't have it in the same detail, but I don't see the same kind of peaks, do you? And I don't have it by day of the week. I only have here just overall, yeah.
Germany is nice and flat.
Huh? Germany is big, so it's big and flat, yeah. Yeah, but that's not broken down by the day of the week, we just did 24 hours.
Waking up?
Yeah, but the thing is, yeah, but so what is
nobody
it
nobody does anything on the weekend.
Yeah, that's right. No, they are doing stuff on the week. These events are continuing the whole time.
Okay.
They just happen to peak, and they're remarkably regular, except for those peaks. Remarkably. All right, so a few clues, all right? They've occurred throughout human history, but this time pattern that you shared has only become prominent in the last few decades. It's not people logging onto Facebook.
Got their birthday at night.
It's not traffic. Yeah, it's not that. But the point is, they never let up, right? Now, next. It's obviously related to the work week, right? Must be. Next. It's not hard sex. It's not turning on the stove, getting in the shower, which is what we're doing.
I remember it.
Yeah, so the number of events have fluctuated around 4 million. The preliminary number for the US was 3.9. The numbers have actually gone down. The numbers went down for a little while during the recession. I think that Trump will probably say they're back up now. I'm sure he's, and it's because of him, right?
Yeah, yeah,
oh yeah, for sure. Very little season variation. Yeah, it went down for a while. I haven't looked at them lately. Japan has the same sort of thing. They have really amazing data. Yeah.
Texting.
Huh? What do you think?
Is it texting?
Texting? It would surely, texting must go down at 5 o'clock in the morning. I know people are on all the time, you know, but there's got to be some hour when there's a dip. But this is absolutely flat from midnight to 6 o'clock or 8 o'clock, right?
It's always happening.
Yeah. Okay, third. Even though there's whatever, it's not the number of lattes or. Okay, we talked about that. The data in figure 1 include all the events of the year. Oh, yeah, that's the sample. And the data are compiled by a very respectable statistical agency. Right? And people in some parts of the world would like to have these patterns, but don't. But I think these patterns have gone, it's a bad pattern. Most people think it's gone too far. This is a fairly new pattern and it's gone too far. Some of it is for the good and some of it we don't think is for the good. There wasn't anything like that. Yeah, so there, and all the other events, they're mostly, I'd say vast majority are happy events. A few may not be so wanted. Unwanted event. And here's one. Now if I show you this, there's one famous person, again recently, where we actually have the data form where the event was recorded. And I'll show you the data form. Once you see the data form, I think you'll see what's going on. Any guesses before that? Obama. When was Obama born? 7/24. In the US, they record the time of birth and put it in the computer. Right? So 7/24 was when Obama, in the evening? Yeah. So, right, so let's go back again. So what are these then?
Shift.
Birds. But
yes.
But so are people having like C-sections? At elective times, that's so weird.
This is elective, mostly elective C-section. Do you know what I mean by elective C-section? Caesarean section when you're born by surgery, rather than naturally, right? And elective means it's not an emergency.
It's planned.
It's planned. Yeah, it's planned. Yeah. So it's a planned deliveries for a certain time. And so now you call it the shift. So my son is a surgeon, and he told me, that, oh, yeah. He said, oh, this is remarkable. He said, every operating room in the United States, he was working there for a couple of years, back here now, every operating room in the United States and probably in Canada starts at 7:30 in the morning. Does that sound, anybody from medicine here? No. Yeah. 7:30 in the morning is when the operating room starts, right?
The first
one is scheduled. So the first, you were told, show up in time, be there. They start prepping you, and he says, we don't go in till about 10 to 8. Why? Because they have to set up the patient, get the anesthesia going, right?
Put the music.
They show up about, so everything is set up for them. And he said, at 10 to 8, the babies are born. The first babies are all born then. So it's a really sharp peak. It is absolutely crazy. Yeah, it is absolutely crazy.
And then also, like, why, like, at 1 p.m. on
Four of our children were born this way. The first one, because they had to be, because he was planned. The second one, she tried to have him naturally, and he was going fine. He refused at the end. And so, so that was whatever. The third one was planned as well, I think. And it was supposed to be planned for here, and we got into the VIC. And then there was an emergency ahead of us, so we were delayed until after lunch. So these are the after lunch, second, the ones, right? Yeah, so it's all there. It's all natural. So let's just go one last thing on that, then go back to the others.
It's interesting because when you change the shift from the night to the day, and you have incoming patients, usually you weigh them for the next.
That's it. You're giving them the next one. That's it. That's it. Exactly. Yeah. So that's one last thing I was going to say. The government website, okay, I got the data from here. They're actually the US are very good about sharing data and making it public. So I was able to get these minute by minute things quite nicely. Yeah, which country leads the wave in cesarean sections? So which country has the highest rate of cesarean sections? What is it now, by the way? Do you have a, are you following it, any of you? What the cesarean section rate is today around the world? It's high.
But I know that there are more planned C-sections nowadays, like more than before.
Absolutely, yeah. But I have a feeling it's up at 20-30%. The WHO and others are trying to get it. So where would you think has the most?
Southeast Asia.
Huh?
China.
You were beaten by others. Is that right?
I don't know.
You are? Yeah?
I think my country is.
Oh, what the hell happened to this? Oh, that's annoying. Yeah. That's annoying.
More than 50%. Huh?
50?
More than 50%.
Okay, well, 50%. You're only second. You're only second.
More than 50%.
Yeah, you're only second. Brazil. Brazil is over 60-something percent. It's an amazing story of how the doctors have convinced poor people. Yeah, poor people. To go for elective cesarean sections. It's crazy. The pattern there is.
And in Bangladesh, it's
kind of the same. It's a status thing. You should do it. It's good. Okay. It's manipulation by the doctors. Mm. You know, and people are very worried because there are side effects from this that are definitely it's needed for some things, But that's why I'm saying it's a bad thing. The excess is too much by far.
Is it manipulation because is it manipulation because like people pay money for that? I'm not sure like if the health system is like.
It's not free. No. So, like, you have to have money to do this, right? So people will spend money for just this as a thing to do.
And in Bangladesh, after delivery, the first question is, it's normal or delivery?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, really? it's after it's a boy or a girl. Okay.
But I think it's all not all about money. I mean,
no.
For C-section, it take $200 in Bangladesh.
I see.
$200. Yeah.
So for
C-section, for normal, I think it's like around $100.
Oh, I see.
So the difference is not that. I think though, maybe now the patient also willing to.
Yeah. No, clearly there's a change in what people want to do. Yeah. But I mean, do you think if you didn't have this and you did have this, where will there be more deaths? That's the question.
Yeah.
Maternal deaths, child deaths. I don't know which way it would go in Bangladesh, but in some countries it's crazy to be. There's no need for it. We have perfectly good systems.
Perfect.
It mightn't be a bad idea. Right? I don't know.
Do some doctors like it though because they can schedule? Like,
Oh yeah. That's just the joke about it. They're out playing golf the rest of the Saturday and Sunday. Right. They squish them all into the thing.
They don't schedule for like Christmas, New Year's.
Yeah. They're moving their patients around. Yeah. Okay, we should get on to some data. Okay. Actually, we should take a break and open the window for a minute, open the door, and then turn on the kettle again. And then let me haul the data up here and talk data analysis.
No, it's really white.
Yeah, but push up the thing and see if let's get some air in here.